Hello, everyone, and welcome to Gather for Good Community Radio. This is our inaugural show. Welcome. We're going to be talking a lot about well-being, human rights, and social justice issues in our community. My name is Priscilla Dyer, and I'm here with my co-host, Priscilla Hernandez.
Hello.
Hello. And we are honored to have as our first guest today, Felicia Pullen. And I'll tell you a little bit about Felicia before she says hello to you. She is an MSW graduate from Fordham University Graduate School of Social Service. She's also the founder of Let's Talk Safety, which is a nonprofit that does work around substance abuse prevention education with children and young adults. And most recently, she is the founder of Safe in Harlem Coalition. So welcome, Felicia. So happy to have you here today.
Thank you, Priscilla. And Priscilla, I'm really happy to be here to share, you know, what we're doing in the community.
So, Felicia, I wanted to ask you, for myself and for our audience members, can you tell us a little bit about Let's Talk Safety? How did that come about?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's Talk Safety was really a brainchild for me as I was trying to figure out how best to impact youth where substance abuse prevention was concerned and education was concerned, because I felt that the more young people knew about the dangers and the pitfalls of substance abuse, the better choices that they would be able to make when deciding whether or not they were going to experiment or deciding if they were going to use substances as part of a tool to fit in with their peers, or, you know, how to stay safe if they were in college. So I thought that the more information and tools that we gave them, the better informed choices they would make.
Okay, and can you tell us a little bit about how Safe in Harlem came to be? When it started and how you formed those relationships, and a little bit about the work that you're trying to do in Harlem.
Yeah. Safe in Harlem was a natural outgrowth of Let's Talk Safety. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to really hone in on a specific community that was near and dear to my heart. I was born and raised in Harlem, and I, from being a child and growing up in that community, was really impacted at a young age by the substance abuse that was prevalent in the 70s with the heroin epidemic, in the 80s with the crack epidemic. And, you know, I saw that there may have been periods of a respite, but as a whole, substance abuse did not go away. Alcoholism was still prevalent. The marijuana culture was still prevalent. Mm-hmm. And now we've come full circle and we see that heroin is on the rise again. And I thought that in order to be effective in the Harlem community, I needed to bring together some of the most respected organizations in that community to help and design a very strong safety net for the youth in that community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And who are some of your partners, and what kind of work do they do?
And at the table with us is Harlem Hospital, Mount Sinai Hospital, and everyone really holds on to their own identity as an institution, but we come together as a collective with one mission in mind, and that's substance abuse prevention for the teens and youth and young adults of Harlem.
Okay, okay. Now, you were also saying that now is it heroin that's the prevalent drug? For me, we hear so much about gentrification, and, you know, we go to these areas and we're seeing cleaner streets and we're seeing a Starbucks on every corner. So what do you say to people that don't really know about what's happening under the surface and the prevalence of drug abuse that's still existing in that community? I mean, what would you say to those individuals? And
Well, I think, first of all, I would say that you have to look beyond the infrastructure mm-hmm. that has occurred, because there's been some economic development in the community. And with that, we have to also take a look at national statistics and understand that that community is not absolved of that issue just because there's gentrification that's occurring. So on a national level, we know that heroin is on the rise. We know that heroin and opiates and other substance abuse is responsible for more deaths than car accidents. And just because gentrification is on the rise in Harlem, that doesn't mean that the predominant population in that community is not still African American. Doesn't mean that the predominant demographics of that community are not still low-income individuals, just because we see an infiltration of more affluent populations coming in. So when the state itself earmarks funds, and I mean New York State, specifically for heroin and opiate abuse, we know that there is an inherent problem in New York, and Harlem is definitely not off the grid where that problem is concerned.
Okay.
Now, you also alluded to the fact that you're working with several organizations, and you still said that they maintained their autonomy. Mm-hmm. So I'm really wanting to know, how do they collaborate? In what, where is your meeting place? Because it's a huge undertaking, and if everyone has their own specific needs or wants or directions, how do you come together? How does that literally coalesce?
And I think that's the beauty of what Safe in Harlem is. It is all of these organizations and institutions that definitely have their own mark on the city. So for example, when we come together, Mount Sinai is our adolescent substance abuse prevention specialist. Harlem Hospital is our overall general health specialist. First Corinthian Baptist Church is our spiritual specialist. But we are all coming together for one purpose, which is substance abuse prevention. So everyone brings their own specialty to the table, but for that one specific purpose of working with the kids in the community.
Okay, here's probably the most important thing that we need to cover today, and I find that this is across the board when it talks about prevention in any arena, whether it be of violence or substance abuse or whatever it is, that there isn't a lot of money available for prevention programs. And I know that recently there's been a mass defunding for organizations like yours that are doing work around prevention, drug abuse prevention. So can you talk to us about that and some of the struggles that your organization is experiencing right now that and the other organizations in your coalition?
Absolutely. It's heartbreaking because there is such a juxtaposition between the need in the community and the funding that is not made available to make the need in the community met. So recently, Safe in Harlem applied for a state grant, and 10 coalitions in New York State, which are structured exactly like, or very much like, Safe in Harlem were funded. When the monies were handed down, it turned out that 8 coalitions in upstate New York, from Ontario all the way to Buffalo, Syracuse, and then up to Westchester, were funded. There was one coalition of our type funded in Staten Island and one in Long Island. So there was massive gaps in that funding process that very much left young people in the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan without the resources to combat heroin and opiate abuse. So what we are doing at this time is trying to bring together not just the strengths of the members at the table, but also piece together the necessary programming without the funds. And it's a very difficult thing to do. However, we have had our partners step up to the table and say, Catholic Charities is one of our partners, and they said, we will go out, our young people will go out and survey the community, do a community assessment, do a photo voice project, so that they will bring it back to the table for us to be able to determine, well, based on what the views of these young people are about alcohol and tobacco advertising that is targeted to them, this is the next right action step that we're going to take to correct the issue. We have our medical partners like Harlem Hospital and Mount Sinai Hospital taking a healthcare fair to the single largest residential structure in the United States, which sits right in the middle of Harlem. We are going to take breast care information. We're going to take diabetes information. We're going to take obesity information. And of course, because our main mission is substance abuse prevention, we're going to bring that, but not as, you know, the front runner, because we want people to come. And we found that when we put substance abuse prevention as the front runner, it's not as attractive as if we bring a holistic approach to care to a community. So our partners are pulling together with their own specific resources to get the job done, but of course we need the funding.
So I'm heartened to know that the coalition is coming together, that people are still willing to do the work and be on the streets and engage. But help me understand and help our listening audience to understand, who are the entities, or how did this allocation, you know, what's the rationalization for the allocation of funds, which seems so disproportionate, at least to my ear, and obviously I don't know enough, but I would like to have some semblance of how that came about.
What's the rationale?
I mean, I'm sure that there's
there's
a need in all of those other communities, but it seems out of proportion for sure.
Yeah, you're right. It's definitely out of proportion, and I think that one of the major issues that urban communities face is that it's being assessed on the same scale as rural, as suburban communities, and that's just not an effective way to determine how to assess the needs of a community. You cannot compare Harlem, and I'm only dealing with one specific zip code within Harlem that has over 60,000 people in one zip code in a 1 square mile area, to a rural community that has maybe 6,000 people in a whole county. So, you know, a rural community can bring the sheriff to the table. So whereas NYPD, there are so many different levels of really getting to the decision makers at NYPD to become active in a community level in a coalition such as this, that, you know, we weren't able to bring an NYPD letter of support, but what we were able to bring was a New York District Attorney's letter of support. So we were told in the assessment process by the state that we did not have NYPD support. Yet at our meetings, we have community unit leaders from the 2-6 and the 2-8 precinct. So it's very difficult to really help the state and OASIS specifically to understand that an urban community is not a rural, is not a suburban community, and therefore there needs to be a complete overhaul of the process by which we're assessed.
So you're fighting this on two fronts, because you're fighting, or you're, in a sense, from digesting what you just said, you are educating the process itself, the decision makers, as to who the population is and how the dynamics work in that community. You can't implant or superimpose, is really the more accurate term, the needs and wants of the of an upstate community to an urban.
It's like a one-size-fits-all mentality.
You know, with many different facets in there. So so that I'm clear what you just said, so the state attorney's letter wasn't enough. It didn't have enough weight, shall we say? Or they needed additional, as if the police department weren't already implied into that?
So what we were told through our debriefing by OASIS, and OASIS is the state organization that allocated these funds, was that we did not make it out of a pre-review process because they did not see a letter from NYPD. But other coalitions within New York City are not able to provide NYPD letters. And we have been granted on other occasions when dealing with federal grants as well, the opportunity to present support from the New York District Attorney's Office. And that should have definitely been enough. I think that we have to deal with a policy issue first and foremost before we can even deal with getting funded on a community level. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it is fighting on more than one front. Mm-hmm. We are fighting the state. We're fighting the governor who said it was okay to defund communities, and I mean entire communities, who have nowhere to send their children because funds have been cut from their substance abuse prevention providers in their communities. So, for example, there is a Hasidic community that now has nowhere to send their children. There is a Greek Orthodox community that has nowhere to send their children. There's a community provider in Crown Heights that was specific to African American children that have nowhere to send their children because Queens is not like Harlem, where someone can maybe walk from 125th Street to 118th Street. And typically we've found that when someone is entrenched in a community for 35, 45, 50 years of providing services, and those children are comfortable and safe and sound and going to these after-school programs, these that also do substance abuse prevention, mm-hmm. because no one place is just about substance abuse prevention. Mm-hmm. They may bring drumming, they may bring fencing, they may bring computers, they may bring mentoring, mm-hmm. they may bring parenting to some kids that may not have that, mm-hmm. because parents may be working two or three jobs, mm-hmm. because, you know, mom and dad may not have the same access to knowledge of care that some have in more well-funded communities. So this is a holistic, comprehensive approach to the well-being of building a strong and healthy young person that have been completely defunded in New York City. And it is heart-wrenching. And we are, right now, boots to the ground, knocking on the door of de Blasio. We are knocking on the door of Cuomo. We are knocking on the door of Commissioner Arlene Gonzalez-Sanchez saying, help us. If there is an appeals process, which we were told through email that there is, but no one's been actually told mm-hmm. Specifically, what is that appeals process? How do we get to that appeals process, and how do we get refunded to continue to bring services to these kids?
Mm-hmm. I mean, let's talk about this now, because literally within 6 months, these organizations are going to be closing their doors.
Yes.
Any funding that they have in their pockets at this time is literally money for them to begin the process of shutting down.
Yes.
So 6 months from now, let's talk about what it's going to look like when this funding is gone and these doors are closed. How many children are going to be impacted, and ultimately what the ripple effect will be in that community? And I'm sure it will affect many other things, not just kids not having access to after school programs. Let's talk about down the line what that's going to look like for the community.
It's a great question, because the ripple effects of not having children in Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and they've been the most impacted by mm-hmm. this defunding, it's going to be devastating, because we're now talking about, you're right, not just having an after-school mm-hmm. program, but when you don't have an after-school program, what does that mean? Where do you go? Mm-hmm. What other activities might be outside of your door that can be risky behavior that will lead to further incarceration of our young people? And predominantly, you know, I mentioned the Greek Orthodox and I mentioned the Hasidic community, but predominantly we're talking about African American and Latino children that are being left out there to fend for themselves. And parents left out there to scramble. So as of June 30th, funding ended for, we're talking about 12 agencies throughout New York City. Some of them were given an extension till December of funds. However, those funds were only earmarked to shut their doors. They cannot use those funds to continue programming for kids during the summer.
Until other funding can be acquired, which would be
And that's why we're
amazing.
Boots to the ground right now. That's why we're boots to the ground right now. So when they say this money is earmarked to close your doors, it is come up with a termination plan. Find storage for your computers. Find storage for your equipment. Get out of your leases that you currently have and shut your doors on probably somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 children around New York City.
So, there's a lot to be said, but what are the plans B, C, and D? What are the contingencies? Because we're talking about young people being left high and dry, and metaphorically and in every other way. What are some of the things, like just give us some idea of what are the things that these organizations you're working with are doing to address some of this, at least to start addressing it?
I wish I could sit here and give, you know, a hopeful outlook. And I wish that I could sit here and say that, you know, a knight in shining armor is going to open up their purse strings and give us $5 million, which is really the amount that was lost, to fund 12 organizations. But that's not happening. So right now, what these agencies are doing are preparing to close their doors. There is no ray of hope right now. And that's why I'm doing everything that I'm doing in order to knock down these doors within the local government with our borough presidents, everything that I can do on the city level with the mayor and the first lady, and on the state level with the commissioner and the governor. But, you know, it's like being caught in a riptide. And you're swimming towards the shore when you know you're not supposed to swim towards the shore. You know, you're supposed to swim linearly, but there is nowhere to go. There are no outlets. There is no respite. There is no life hook or life jacket being thrown for them. You know, and I am doing everything that I possibly can to make these stories known. We did have an article that ran in the July 13th issue of the New York Times, which is definitely bringing light to the situation, but we need further help.
I know this is, I know what you had planned originally compared to what you'd have to downsize to is it's like night and day, but all things considered, what are some of the smaller projects that you think individuals and maybe some organizations, some corporations would be, can be solicited to fund in the meantime so that you're not at a total stopping point and you're able to move forward while you're advocating for yourself for those larger funds? What can the average person do to help?
You know, it's all about the children, right? It's not about these agencies and organizations. It is all about the children. So, you know, if your listeners really care about these young people in New York City who are losing services, they can write their council people. They can write their borough presidents. They can write the governor and say, stop the defunding of these agencies and save our children. You know, in addition to you know, monetary donations. I think that, you know, everybody, if we pulled in the same direction, I mean, there are over 7 million people in New York City alone. So if everybody gave a dollar, we would be good, right? We would be good. But I can be contacted for further information by phone, and yes, I will put my number out there because this is a dire situation, no pun intended. my number is 800-560-0612, and I can be reached via email at fpullen@letstalk.safety.org.
Okay, and your website?
Yes, beautiful website that we have is www.letstalksafety.org.
Felicia, thank you so much for being with us. And is there anything else you want to say, Priscilla?
No, I would just add that yes, to echo what you just said, people need to contact their elected officials. Elected officials listen, especially if you write en masse. If you can't get the whole community, get 10 people, and those 10 people get another 10 people. I know this. I work with government, and they really do listen. Pick up the phone. Actually, visit your council member's office. Guess what? Those are open to you. You pay for them. It's our funds. Let them know you're not happy. So whatever we can do to have this be turned around and to bring attention to it, let's just do it. That's all I would add to that.
Thank you.
Words of wisdom. Thank you all for listening. Hope to see you next time. Take care.